This is Deputy Sheriff Nicholas Vincent Castoro.
There's so many more cases that people...
Last of the day before the storm, Mr. Alexander.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Samuel Alexander, and I represent HM on behalf of HS in this case. This court should reverse and remand because the evidence, when taken in the light most favorable to HS, shows that the deputy's application of force was excessive in violation of clearly established law. Therefore, he was not entitled to qualified immunity.
Could you tell me, I think I know it, but I just want to make sure, everything we know from the evidence examined in the light most favorable to the plaintiff about the actual takedown. You know, it would be so good to have a video in this case, but obviously we don't. So, you know, it seems like the plaintiff really doesn't know much about the takedown other than he was taken down, from what I read.
Yes.
And his little companion added some, but not a whole lot.
Well, his companion added that if we start at the point where the interaction takes place, and I think it's important to remember that the interaction took place in the first place because a neighbor called and said that, some kids were maybe taking something out of her yard. The deputy said that he got a call about some sort of disturbance, and he was sent to scare the kids, basically. So he pulls over. He asks the children for their names. RS gives his name, and HS calmly refuses to give his name repeatedly.
I know, but let's get to the takedown.
Okay, to the takedown. So the takedown, that's where the facts start to get disputed. RS says that after HS continued to refuse to take his hands out of his pockets, the deputy's face turned red. He lunged at HS. He tried to take HS's hands out of his pockets. HS briefly
resisted.
Because he said he didn't know what was happening, because there was no...
Because he felt like he shouldn't be getting arrested, right?
At first, he didn't know that he was getting arrested. And then he felt like he shouldn't be getting arrested.
Okay.
And that's because there was no announcement, you're under arrest. There was no...
So there's a scuffle between them where Castor's attempting to control HS's hands. What do we know then?
And we know at that point that the deputy, who weighs 250 pounds and is a linebacker, lifted HS up by his waist. HS weighs 120 pounds and was 13 years old, and slammed him, body slammed him face first, like a wrestling move is what.
All right. Tell me the testimony where we know that's what I'm getting at. With the actual takedown, I mean, you know, he told him repeatedly, or at least more than once, take his hand out of the pocket, wouldn't do it. And then he took him down. Who says he reached around him, and did he turn him upside down, or was he behind him?
Slammed him on the ground like a wrestling move. Where does that come from?
That comes from the deposition of RS.
At page 32, right?
31 and 32.
Yeah. But RS says, like, that's what he told the police in the first, he said he tackled him in the first interview with the police in the second. And then he changed his story. And then when he came, there was a trial where HS's charges for assault and resisting arrest with violence were
dismissed.
He was not found guilty of those. He was found. There was different testimony from RS at that trial. He changed the story back to what he maintains happened all along, which was that HS never did anything that was threatening. He remained calm.
All right, but
can I go through the Graham factors with you?
Yes.
Thank you. So I want to start with the severity of the crime. And I want to focus on what really is what this is about, which is what you were just talking with Judge Carnes about, which is the body slam. Because that's really what the force that was used that you're seeking to get compensation for. And I understand that. That's what led to all the harm here. Before that happened, I think we just established, there was resistance with violence, correct?
Without.
So I think you said violently resisted is what I think you said. But if you didn't, that's fine.
You said it, but I believe you corrected it.
Okay. So whatever you said, the officer, Deputy Castoro went to lunge for the arm, tried to get the arms out, and your client didn't believe that he should be either arrested and then later, or didn't know he was under arrest and then didn't believe and resisted his arms being taken out, correct?
Correct.
That's resisting with violence, is it not?
I don't believe so.
Okay. So if I believe under Florida law that that is resisting with violence, then that would be a felony preceding what happened here, would it not?
So I think you have to go back to the original, the lawfulness of the...
Well, answer my question first, and then I'll be happy to hear what you have to say. If I believe under Florida law, under Florida case law, that that is resisting with violence, that would be a violent felony under federal law
if
preceding the wrestling move, correct?
If the arrest is lawful.
Would he have probable cause at that moment that...
So I think if a police officer walks up to someone who has their hands in their pockets and just grabs them.
Of course. Of course. Then let's back up then. That's a great point. Maybe I should have started there. So in Florida, where a person goes onto the property of another with the intent to take, real property, goes into the real property, the home of another, with the intent to take something, what do we call that in Florida? That's a burglary, is it not? Felony, right? Yeah.
Correct.
Isn't that what happened here?
Not at
least. As I understand the facts, the boys went on the property of a neighbor, uninvited, and they took a ball from that property without permission and left with the ball, and then the neighbor called.
Respectfully, I disagree with that.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Didn't Deputy Castoro not have that information?
He did not.
Okay, did somebody in the police department have that information? That wasn't what was called in to dispatch? What I just said?
So a woman called and said that there is a boy maybe took something from someone's yard.
Yard, not building, not house.
No, in Florida, curtilage is part of the dwelling, is it not?
He took it from a ditch. So,
well, I know what he actually...
What was the dispatcher told?
It's unclear. He testified that he was told there was some sort of disturbance, and he had no, perhaps, to trespass.
No, what was dispatch told? It was what you just said first said. Were they not told that someone went into the yard and took the ball?
They were told that there was a boy who had taken a ball from someone's yard.
Right.
Even that in Florida does not mean that there's a trespass.
It certainly means there's a trespass if it's not that person's yard, but more importantly, if it was done with the intent to steal something and it's on the curtilage of someone's home, then that very much is a burglary, is it not?
There's no evidence that happened, though. So if I could explain, in Florida, in a neighborhood like this, the ditches are retention portions of yards that are by the side of the road. It's not the person's problem.
But counsel, it's not about what actually happened. It's about what the officer or the collective knowledge of the police department, what they believed at the time.
And the neighbor called 911, as I understand it, to report two juvenile males walking in her yard and taking items from neighborhood yards. Is that not right?
Yes, that is correct. And if we take it down to the level of what was known, then I think we have to zoom into the deputy himself. Because he was the one who was there, and he was the one who employed the firm.
I know, but for probable cause, we use collective knowledge. And so at that point, he absolutely could have arrested, and at the very least done an investigatory stop, which is what he did, and what we all acknowledge that he did. You never contest the initial stop, because you can't for that reason. And once you have that, he certainly is allowed to make sure that someone's hands are there and that people don't have weapons in their pockets.
There's no objective evidence that the child had a weapon in his
pocket. Whether he did or didn't,
it doesn't matter.
If a police officer is investigating something, a Terry stop, they're allowed to do a pat down for their safety, right?
Correct.
Okay. Here, he asked, then aggressively asked, repeatedly refused, and then went to take the hands out, and at that point, there was physical resistance.
There was a brief physical resistance.
How is that not resisting with violence?
Because he was shocked and he was surprised and it was a...
I don't blame him, but that's not the question. The question is, why is there not probable cause at that point for resisting with violence?
He was never found guilty of resisting without violence.
That
doesn't mean there's not probable cause for the charge.
I think even for the sake of argument and to move it forward, let's assume that he resisted with minimal violence.
The problem is both of those things are really important. It goes to the felony, which takes away your clearly established argument, which takes away the first factor, which weighs heavily, and every argument after that is predicated on the fact that this was all just some way overreaction, when in fact what he was doing at that time was doing an investigatory stop with someone who wouldn't show their hands, and when they went to do something, was physically resisted. At that point, that changes the calculus significantly for the Graham factors, does it not?
I think it does not, because this court's precedent holds that even minor violent crimes are still minor crimes for purposes of the Graham factor analysis. So something like a trespass and stealing a ball from someone's yard on the scope of even disorderly conduct under the Feast case is considered a crime that does not connote a level of dangerousness that would justify a greater use of force.
Yeah, but but resisting with violence?
I would dispute that he resisted with violence.
I thought the whole point of this line of inquiry was you had just said you were going to assume that there was probable cause for that charge. See, that's the point Judge Luck was trying to make.
If I may redirect little bit differently. My read on this tentatively, and it may be wrong, but probable cause to arrest him for something in the yard, in the drainage ditch, or something like that is, in my view, irrelevant. He was called there and went there entirely legitimately to find out what was going on. And once he got there, as I understand his theory, I felt, whether he's articulated these words or not, I felt like there was a danger because he had something in his pocket. And I asked him to take his hand out of his pocket, and he wouldn't. We had a case, it's a published opinion, out of Selma, Alabama. And I wrote it, so we know it's right. And the guy was just hanging around the store or something like that, no particular crime. And an officer deputy was called there. And he got there, and the guy had a hatchet in his hand. And he kept walking towards the officer, and the officer said, drop it, drop it, drop it. And he didn't, and he shot him dead when he got within striking distance. Now, we said it doesn't matter what happened before then, because an officer is interacting with somebody, which he's got the right to do in the public area. And if he feels legitimately there's a danger, he can respond with reasonable force if necessary to remove the danger. So I think maybe that's why I was focusing on the takedown. Mm-hmm. He had a right to stop this young man and make sure he didn't have something in his pocket that he could hurt the officer or try to hurt the officer with. And the question is, was that reasonable? Was that the least?
I don't think it was reasonable. I think that...
Because what else could he do? Now, what else could he do?
Hand
was still in the pocket.
His hand is still in the pocket. But I think we have to remember that his story was his hand was in his pocket and he asked him to take it out because sometimes people can be dangerous. He did not say he believed in this specific incident that there was any specific danger. It wasn't until, under his version of events, HS pulled out a knife that there was danger. And so when that story becomes discredited, a jury is free to disbelieve any claim leading up to that he believed that there was a danger, and we can instead rely on HS.
I don't buy that. If there's not, I mean,
there's no evidence in the record aside from his testimony that he believed there was a
danger.
And that is inextricably.
There's not evidence in the record that the young man didn't have his hand in his pocket, is there?
No.
Okay. The officer said he had a hand in his pocket. You got two witnesses who are on the side of the young man, his companion, and neither one of them dispute that.
Correct.
So it's undisputed evidence he had his hand in his pocket.
Correct.
Now the question is that reasonable response to the hand in the pocket and repeated requests which were not complied with to take the hand out of the pocket? And unfortunately, we don't have, it's hard for me to see how this much damage could be done by just putting the guy on the ground. But
that's not the evidence, what the evidence shows happened. The evidence shows that he momentarily resisted, and the officer, instead of using his overwhelming power to put the hands behind his back, became enraged, lifted him up in the air, and threw him down face first on the cement.
Where do we get the face first on the cement?
Because he broke his
From the injuries.
He broke his skull. Yeah. He broke his sinuses. He broke his jaw. He broke his right shoulder blade, and he broke his right three ribs.
And he had a black eye.
Okay. Well, a jury could.
And his brain was bleeding. He was in the ICU.
Jury could certainly infer from that he put him down on the ground, although it was grass, wasn't it?
It was cement. They were on grass originally, and when the body slam, when the wrestling move, as R.S. describes it.
Now, how do we?
His feet were up in the air. He was dangling.
All right, let's take that item by item. I think this, to me at least, is the most important part of the issue. How do we know it was the cement as opposed to the grass? There was grass going up to cement. How do we know it was cement?
It's in the record somewhere. I can find it during rebuttal, although I'm over my rebuttal time.
Okay.
But I think just the extent of the injuries themselves. I mean, slamming someone into the grass is not going to create a bunch of individual bone breaks in your skull and your sinuses and your...
I don't know about that.
I don't think that. It's in the record that he was on this.
All right. And his legs were in the air. How do we know that?
He testified to that. He said he was okay. Lifted out of the air and his legs were dangling.
All right. But he also said he didn't know exactly how it happened.
He didn't know if he was manipulated after being lifted up into the air. He said, I didn't know if he turned me around or what, but he was slammed onto the ground after being lifted up.
And his little companion said a wrestling-like move.
It was like a wrestling.
And nobody... I guess both sides thought it could get worse for me if I asked him to demonstrate what he's talking about. I mean, you know, that sort of begs the question. It implies violence, but that's all he said is a wrestling-like move?
Well, first he said he tackled him, and then he said that he slammed him down to the ground like a wrestling move. And I think that
right. All right, I've taken up enough time on that.
Thank you. Good morning, may I please the court? Summer Barranco here on behalf of the appellee, Deputy Castoro.
Why don't the injuries show, given the... Now, I started to say combatants, there wasn't much combat. The two principals involved, why didn't the injuries show that jury could find this was unreasonable force?
Well, Your Honor, I think most plaintiffs' lawyers down trial court level would love for that to be the case.
Well, I don't care about that. I don't have a lot of fans down there, so I don't play to them. What?
Well, the reason they don't, Your Honor, is obviously the severity of the injuries is only one of the Graham factors, which we know are not.
Yeah, but these are very severe injuries, and the disparity in size. Oh.
One thing I wanted to address, Your Honor, the question that you had asked my opposing counsel a moment ago about the striking the head on the cement.
Yeah, it said grass somewhere.
Yes, in the plaintiff's statement of facts, Your Honor, in opposition to the summary judgment below, it was docket entry 44, paragraph 27. The fact that was asserted by Castoro was R.S., the friend, saw the plaintiff go down at the side of the road in the grass. And in response to that, the plaintiff stated that that was disputed. When Castoro slammed the plaintiff to the ground, the plaintiff hit pavement. Castoro's narrative was upon Hayden, that was the name of the plaintiff, reaching the ground, his body landed in the grassy area, but the side of his head struck the paved road.
All right, that was the plaintiff's response to the proposed. Okay, so part of him hit the paved road.
Just happened to be when he was taken down in the moment that the deputy was.
I understand. I'm just trying to figure out what the facts were.
Yes, well, that's.
Did your client say why he had to use that much force? Why he couldn't have done with less force? I mean, I don't believe in critiquing officers, micromanaging what they do, spur of the moment, and that sort of thing, but my gracious goodness.
Well, part of the problem, Your Honor, as was admitted by the plaintiff or the appellant and his friend, was that he wasn't cooperating.
I understand, but you can't raffle move somebody into pavement if they're not cooperating with the cops.
Was there evidence of an intent to put him on the pavement?
Absolutely no. In fact, the intention was to get him on the grass. My
question is this: this is an evaluation of the Graham factors, which is obviously legally what we are supposed to be doing. The force that we look at, is it the force that is actually done by the officer, or is it the consequence of it? Because the severity of the injury goes to the consequence, but the force is often not related to the consequence at all. In other words, let's take an eggshell plaintiff, for example. There could be a push, which the amount of force is almost nothing, but the severity of it is extreme. And so I guess my question is, in looking, because one of the factors is, and the one that Judge Carnes asked about, is the amount of force in relation to the need at the time, is picking someone up and slamming them to the ground in a wrestling-like move, which is what I understand the testimony to be, is that level of force not related to what happened and everything leading up to that moment? Because that seems to be what really the question is.
Absolutely, and if I may, it all started when the deputy simply asked the child his name, and the friend gave his name, his own name, but the plaintiff did not, and then the deputy sees.
Well, didn't quite start there, right? Because there was a crime that happened before that.
Sure, even before the deputy was on scene, and I fast-forwarded just for brevity's sake, that once the deputy's arriving and just asking their names, the plaintiff isn't giving the name, and then further puts his hands in his hoodie pockets, and the deputy's telling him, take your hands out of your pockets, and he's like, no, I'm not going to.
What did the deputy perceive with his hands? As I understood it, the testimony was he perceived something. What was that?
He perceived that the boy was grabbing something inside his hoodie.
Holding on to something, right?
But the young man denied it, did he not?
The young man denied that he ever brought the knife out, which he conceded on the summary judgment record. Actually, below, if I'm not...
Let me ask something. Could he deny the perception of the officer? Is that a contestable fact that he can deny?
Our position was and is that no, he could not. The plaintiff can't deny what's in the deputy's mind, and we all know that Graham.
So if the officer testified, I thought he had an AK-50. That'd be an AK-15 on his back, strapped on it. I don't know what I was thinking, but that was my genuine thought. He can't deny that.
Well, I suppose if it was something that was overt, that other witnesses could clearly see was not the case, then that may be the situation. But in this situation, no one else had the vantage point or the perspective of Deputy Castoro.
Let me ask you about this knife. Where is it?
During all of this?
No, I mean as a separate physical entity today, where is the knife?
That's a good question. If I had to guess, it's probably in evidence somewhere. I honestly don't remember this.
And if we wanted to find out about more particulars about the knife, where in the record would we go to get a photo of the knife?
I don't know if there was a photograph of the knife.
Because y'all just try this case for the deposition that you're taking that particular day and don't care about the later appellate court review. I mean, come on.
Well, I know it was described as a pocket knife and that it was closed. And ultimately, at the end of the day, Your Honor, for purposes of the summary judgment motion, Deputy Castoro conceded that the knife never, in fact, did come out of the pocket. And that was to, frankly, assist the trial court in being able to look at the material facts that.
So the first time he knew that the young man had a knife was after he had already slammed him to the ground.
According to the conceded facts for the summary judgment purpose, yes, he did not specifically know what it was he had in his hand in his pocket, but he did know that the kid was not.
He perceived that he was reaching for something, and in fact, there was something there. We know that it was a pocket knife. It's not something he saw until afterward.
Correct. That's the statement of facts that are undisputed for purposes of the summary judgment motion, which we know aren't always the actual facts.
You know, is this the pocket of an enclosure on a hoodie that goes all over the front of your stomach and it's big as opposed to a side pocket?
According to the record evidence, the undisputed facts was it was a single large pocket that when you put your hands in, they could touch each other in the pocket.
In the future, it would be ever so great if y'all had something where a knife played a central role. Just take a picture of it, or a gun, yeah, or a pair of knuckles.
I hear you, Your Honor. I don't believe that was done on the scene, and it wasn't done subsequently, maybe because it didn't exist anymore. If my memory serves, and I was the lawyer during the trial court proceedings, I believe I did do a request for production of the hoodie, and it didn't exist anymore. That I do remember. I don't specifically remember the knife. I know I normally always want that stuff if I need to go to trial.
But you were so cocky about not going to trial, you just didn't go with it, right?
I would never, ever do that, Your Honor, because I know that can bite you for sure. And just like my clients, I don't have a crystal ball because you never know what's going to happen. Nor did Deputy Castoro know what was going to happen, but he did know that this young man was, for whatever reason, you know, not giving his name, putting his hands in his pocket, not taking them out of his pocket, and he tried things much less severe, if I even want to use that word, than taking him down to the ground. And unfortunately,
what did he try other than asking him and grabbing his hands?
Well, he asked him, and then he grabbed his hands and tried to physically pull his hands to be able to restrain him so that he would be secured, because there was a safety concern at that point. And if he had been able to just do that, that probably would have been the end of it. Of course, could have been that he would have broken the minor's arm, as some of the other cases happened. I recall the one case that was with, I remember the part about it, it was at a Luke Bryant concert. It was the Horn case. A mother had her arm broken by the deputy at a Luke Bryant concert, and this court stated that was not excessive force because there was a legitimate reason for the force, and our position is there was a legitimate reason for this use of force. It was because of the safety concerns. He wasn't taking his hands out of his pockets, and the deputy saw that he was grabbing something, and he frankly was just trying to secure this kid so he didn't have to worry about having a knife or whatever else he might have had in his pocket suddenly, you know.
In looking at the need versus the amount of force, is it relevant? And if it is, what relevance here? In other words, what facts go to the fact that other options were used before this need was used or this particular amount of force was used?
What other options?
Yeah, in other words, did he tell him first, take your hands out?
Absolutely,
right.
Yes.
How many times?
More than once, right. Multiple times.
And did he try just to take his hands out, or did he immediately slam him to the ground?
No, he first tried to physically take his hands out of his pockets, and the undisputed facts. And that's what, frankly, distinguishes this case from a lot of the cases where summary judgment isn't granted. It was undisputed that not only did he refuse to give a name, he refused to give him his hands, he refused to just submit to handcuffing, which is what then prompted the deputy to react in you know, fast, rapidly evolving situation. We're not talking a deadly force situation because the deputy at the front end didn't exactly know what the kid had in his pocket. But I don't think it's unreasonable for a deputy in this situation to to not just go, oh, okay, this kid don't want to take his hands out of his pocket and I'm seeing he's grabbing something, I better just wait and see what he's going to do.
So looking at the need versus the justification, for, in other words, the need with the amount, is the fact that alternatives were used to play into the escalating force that was ultimately used.
Absolutely.
In the case.
And in fact, in the briefs, I recall that the appellant suggested at one point that no force should have been used, and at another point suggest that, well, you know, he could have done an arm bar takedown or a leg sweep, and say a leg sweep, something else could happen. He could have also broke his head, just like in the Patel case, that a leg sweep was found by, I believe, the 11th Circuit to be excessive. So in a lot of ways, the deputy's confronted kind of with a Hobson's choice. He's confronted with a resisting person who's not cooperating. He's got a safety concern, and he's not required to just sit and let the kid do whatever he wants, regardless of what the deputy's safety concern is.
And he can use force. This is a qualified immunity case.
Well, actually, below, the trial court found that it was not even a Fourth Amendment violation.
No, but you asserted it as a qualified immunity defense, right?
I asserted it as both. Number one, that there wasn't a Fourth Amendment violation.
Right.
And if there was, the deputy's entitled to qualified immunity because the law wasn't clearly established under these sorts of facts that he couldn't do a mere...
Could affirm on that ground, couldn't we?
Absolutely. You could affirm on...
We could whether it crossed some threshold of force.
Sure.
That it wasn't so clear that the officer would have had fair notice.
Where in this process and when did the officer tell HS that he was under arrest?
I don't recall where that is or what it is in the record. I do know that he wasn't specifically told when he was first being taken down or his hands were being grabbed, because at that point, I don't think it was the deputy's intention to arrest him. He wasn't being arrested for...
So he wasn't under arrest when the body slammed.
He was trying to just secure his hands, so he wasn't a safety concern.
Was the testimony of HS that, while not told that he was under arrest, and while initially was confused as to why he was lunging at his hands, he continued to resist because he didn't think he should be under arrest? Was that not HS's testimony?
Yes, that was the plaintiff's testimony. He knew what was happening. He knew that he wasn't cooperating with what the deputy wanted him to do.
In other words, before the body slam, while he lunged for the hands, it was his belief that he was under arrest, but he just believed he shouldn't be under arrest at that point.
I believe that's true. I mean, I can't speculate to what the plaintiff was thinking.
All he's asking about is what he testified to.
I understand.
He testified too that I resisted because initially I didn't know why he was doing this, and then he said something to the effect of I didn't believe I should be under arrest.
That's correct. I do remember that. Yes.
Which means he perceived he was under arrest.
Right. There wasn't any real surprise here, especially given the context. It wasn't like the deputy just walked up to this kid for no reason and started picking him up and throwing him down.
Is the testimony that the deputy explained to him when he drove up to him why he was coming up to him?
Well,
as I understood it, the answer was yes to that, but I think your time's up. We can hear from your opposing counsel on that.
Very good, and I'm certain that Your Honor has a better memory of the briefs than I do. I've been reading a lot of the case law. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Alexander.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, regarding Deputy Castoro's testimony about what he told HS and RS, he testified, I think, that he walked up to them and I think told them what was going on or something to that effect. But I don't remember what the details were. I don't believe he did either. I think this case really should hinge on the standard used to view the facts, because I think there are assumptions that are being made that are not taking inferences in the light most reasonable to the plaintiff.
Which one?
For example, that Deputy Castro perceived that there was a threat.
Well, so I'm having trouble. You had this colloquy with Judge Carnes, and And I'm confused by your answers there to him. So your view, as I understand, is because there are other things that Deputy Castoro lied about, that means a jury could then not believe him regarding that. That's as I understand your argument.
Well, and he actually never testified that he perceived that there was an immediate threat.
No, he didn't say immediate. What he said, here's what I understood his testimony. Correct me if I'm wrong, and tell me if it's contradicted. Number one, I believed he was holding something or grabbing or something. And two, I thought it might be a weapon or something that could have harmed me. Okay, so that last part you don't believe is in the record?
No,
okay.
He said that based on his training and experience, often when people refuse to take their hands out of their pockets, that can be a situation that means that the person is potentially dangerous.
Meaning in this situation, my training tells me that this person is dangerous, right?
Could potentially be dangerous,
right.
And therefore I ask him to take his hands out of
I think I agree completely that that's what the testimony is.
But I do not, and then the testimony goes on to say that he pulled the knife out of his pocket. And that's where the dispute arises.
And as I understand it, the R&R and the district court did not view that in the light most favorable to you, and we are viewing that in the light most favorable to you. No one is saying here that the knife was
out,
ever pulled or taken out.
Correct. But I think that there's an inference from sometimes people in these circumstances have the potential to be dangerous to I felt like there was a danger in this circumstance. And he never testified to that.
I understand the difference.
That's important, I think, because he, reading the case law, a lot of the standard things that somebody would do in that situation would be to ask, do you have a weapon? I'm concerned that, you know, I'm going to place you under arrest. I want to give you a pat down. Do you have anything in your pockets? The testimony of RS was that when HS calmly refused to take his hands out of his pockets, that Deputy Castro's face turned red, and that then the evidence shows that he tried to wrench the hands out of his pockets, and HS didn't know what was going on.
The red face.
From a situation where I beg your pardon?
The red face has no bearing on the case because it's an objective standard, is it not?
I think that the red face goes to the legitimacy of the law enforcement need. So if there's case law that says that if the law enforcement need is because someone perceives a threat, that's more acceptable than if the reason for the action is that someone is...
So red face is inconsistent with perceiving a threat?
I think that a jury can find that the reason, based on the red face, a jury could find that the reason that the deputy attempted to wrench HS's hands from his pockets was not because he perceived a threat, but because he was enraged by HS's disobedience. I think a reasonable jury could find that. And I think that means that for purposes of summary judgment, this court...
Even if a reasonable law enforcement officer would have perceived a threat and acted as this officer did, if this officer had a bad motive for acting that way, he has violated the defendant's constitutional rights.
I don't think that this court can say that under any circumstances when an officer is interacting with a 13-year-old child and the child refuses to remove hands from their pockets, all reasonable officers in that situation would perceive that there's a threat.
You don't think that we could say all reasonable officers would perceive that there might be a threat?
And that's what he said, but he didn't... No.
And my question is, we couldn't say that? That all reasonable officers would perceive there might be? A reasonable officer would perceive that might be a threat.
You could certainly rule that. But I think that a...
Well, and if that's true, then the notion that this officer didn't perceive a threat, that subjective issue is irrelevant.
I think that it would be unreasonable. I don't think you can hold that... I guess if that's your reasoning, then that's the case. But I disagree that a ruling that I think it has to be very fact bound. And I think holding that any time any reasonable officer could potentially perceive that there might be a threat means that the officer is permitted to engage to wrench someone's hands out of their pockets without giving any sort of warning is too broad. I think in this case...
I agree with that, but of course that's not what happened here. This officer told him to remove his hands, and he refused to do so. Then the officer tried to remove them himself, and he resisted it. I mean, we're talking about far more than that, but I think we understand your case, Mr. Alexander, and we're going to be in recess until tomorrow.
Thank you.